This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
with just 2 weeks to go before Kenya's election, the nation watched the lead opposition candidate for president, Raila Odinga, debate solo Monday after his top opponent, President Uhuru Kenyatta, refused to show for the live event.
That's VOA's Mohamed Yusuf reporting from Nairobi. Details next.
Also, the UN says funds are dwindling for South Sudanese refugees fleeing to neighboring countries. And the HIV epidemic is coming under control among all age groups in Swaziland, which has the highest HIV prevalence in the world.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story, with just 2 weeks to go before Kenya's elections, the nation watched the lead opposition candidate for president, Raila Odinga, debate solo Monday. This after his top opponent, President Uhuru Kenyatta, refused to show up for the live event. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi on what this may tell us about the race ahead.
Opposition leader Raila Odinga had the stage to himself for the televised presidential debate. He responded to questions from the two moderators for 90 minutes.
I am running here because of my commitment to change this country. I represent change.
Odinga promised to address the rising cost of living and to fight corruption, ban those in government from doing business with his administration. He said the current government is overboring on large infrastructure projects. His challenges went unanswered. The podium for his opponent, President Uhuru Kenyatta, stood empty. Kenyatta's team said he will not attend the debate because they were not happy with the format and rules. Kimani Ichungwa is a member of parliament from central Kenya. His party is part of Kenyatta's Jubilee coalition.
We have told you we need to lay out this debate in a certain way that will be fair to everybody, will give and accord Kenyans the opportunity to be able to decide on the basis of issues, not personality fights, not inflaming emotions, political emotions in a country where political emotions are very high at the moment, on account of that principle that the organizers ignored, refused, because they had an ulterior motive.
The presidency released a statement Tuesday saying the president would engage with Kenyans directly, including plans to speak to an additional 40 radio stations before the vote. Three of the other six presidential candidates debated during the first half of the event. This is the fourth time Odinga is running for the top job. The race is expected to be tight, though it is not clear what impact the debate will have on voters. Identity politics remain the norm in Kenya, with ethnicity and regional loyalty governing people's choices at the polls. What Odinga called during the debate a homeboy mentality. But there are some undecided voters, as much as 5% of the electorate. According to recent polls done by Infotrack and Sinovet, those undecided voters were Odinga's target Monday, says Kenyan political commentator Barak Moloka.
The government missed an opportunity to state its position, to call the bluff in what these people are saying, and to show where the weaknesses and failures in these people's thoughts are, if any.
There were no major revelations in Odinga's statement during his solo debate. He pledged to respect the results of a free, fair and credible election. Kenyans go to the polls August 8th. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
With no end in sight to South Sudan's violence and conflict, the UN says funds for South Sudanese refugees are dwindling. It says only 30% of the needed $1.4 billion has been received for those fleeing to Uganda, Ethiopia, Sudan, Kenya, as well as the DRC and CAR. AFP reports the UN Regional Coordinator for South Sudanese Refugees says the 70% funding shortfall comes as the crisis is being made worse by hunger and disease. Arnold Akojenu says the crisis is man-made. He says donors must acknowledge the tragic situation and that mass starvation among refugees cannot be ruled out.
South Sudanese refugees in Uganda say the ongoing reduction in food rations have made it very difficult to feed their families. They say the rations are not nearly enough to last an entire month. Some have even risked their lives and returned to South Sudan hoping to find food for their families. It's not certain whether the full rations will resume as refugee agencies grapple with funding gaps. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
The World Food Program cut rations in half last May at Uganda's camps for South Sudanese refugees. The funding cuts have affected 800,000 refugees in Yumbe, Adjumani, Koboko, Arua, and Moyo districts. These refugees are currently getting 6 kilograms of maize and sorghum cereal per month as compared to 12 kilos per month early this year. Ronald Apeku is a field officer with World Vision, an organization that oversees food distribution in the settlements.
Previously, they were getting more or less slightly higher rations, but because of the current reductions, we had ration reductions being approved by UNHCR, WFP, OPM, and other partners. So currently, there is a reduction.
But refugees say the reductions have caused severe hardships for them. Tombol Nwera is a refugee at the Ailo settlement in Adjumani district.
But the thing that's usually being given to us, like food, they are not enough for us. Like food, for example, last 3 years, 3 months, we shall receive 3 kg for one person for a month. So the kgs who are being given to one person here in Ailo are not enough. So that one is affecting us here in the settlement.
Another refugee, Susan Didi, lives in the Paglinya settlement in Adjumani district.
Some of us, we are getting punishment, truly. Really, this food we they are giving us, it is not enough for us.
According to Tombol, the ration reduction has forced some refugees to return to their volatile country to search for food. Many have not made it back.
One thing again, which is affecting us, we have our children, and even some children are now back to South Sudan. They die between Nimili and Jupa. That effect of 3 kgs with the people here in Ailo.
Elias Aju is a teacher at one of the schools in Ailo settlement. He says the hunger caused by ration cuts has forced children out of schools.
Recently, there was a crisis of food. That is why some of the people miss school. Even up to now, they are not all. They are supposed to be 118. Now they are 92.
World Food Program spokesperson Lydia Wamala says the UN agency cannot estimate when the refugees might receive full rations again.
At the moment, about 2,000 people are arriving every day in Uganda, and the World Food Program needs to provide them with life-saving food and nutrition support. We are currently spending $16 million a month to support the refugees, and we have a shortfall of $60 million in the coming 6 months. We need the support of donors and governments out there to help us to feed these people as they continue to arrive.
With the current rations, an adult receives an amount that is only recommended for a 3-year-old. Only new arrivals and the vulnerable are receiving full rations. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
France hosted a summit today on Libya. President Emmanuel Macron met Fayez al-Sarraj, the Prime Minister of the UN-backed Government of National Accord, and his rival, General Khalifa Haftar, commander of the National Army. At the end of the meeting, the two men committed themselves to calling for a ceasefire and holding elections in early 2018. President Macron says Sarraj and Haftar struck a historic agreement to hold elections. AFP reports a 10-point statement said in part that the two men would refrain from any use of armed force for any purpose that does not strictly constitute counterterrorism. Libya has been in political turmoil and conflict since the fall of longtime ruler Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Reporter Catherine Field is following developments from Paris. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the summit.
What we're seeing here, Joe, is Emmanuel Macron trying to play the peacemaker and trying to get France back at the top table. France has done a pretty good turnaround when it's come to Libya, as from what we saw with Nicolas Sarkozy, who was, of course, in power when Gaddafi was toppled. Emmanuel Macron has come in and said, well, you know, we really do need to talk to both sides. We need both sides at the table, and there can be no way forward unless both sides come to the table. Emmanuel Macron's sheen, if you like, is wearing off a bit. He came to power promising lots of good initiatives, but nothing's actually come off yet. So for him to be able to concrete his plays as a world leader, he needs to have some sort of diplomatic success. And he's hoping that bringing just a ceasefire to Libya will give him that extra weight when it comes to the top table diplomatically.
What does peace in Libya mean for France?
In the short term, it will mean the end of migrant arrivals. What France is very concerned about is that the number of migrants arriving across the Mediterranean just keeps climbing. That is their main concern. On top of that, there is a concern that Libya is a failed state and that Islamist-inspired fighters are having a base there, and that from there, perhaps, there is the possibility to direct or to inspire more attacks here in France. There are these domestic issues that are a big issue here in France. Migrants and the threat of terrorism are really number one and number two on people's worry list here.
Now, Catherine, yesterday I understand that EU and African interior ministers met in Tunis. What was that about?
That was again about trying to bring some sort of order to the migrant crisis. There were the members of the European Union, plus Algeria, Mali, Niger, Chad, and Tunisia. What they've done is they're trying to get these interior ministers together and address the problems of exactly why migrants leave home. Not so much of trying to stop them from arriving in France or in Italy, but to actually address the real reasons why they are leaving home. But also, they came together and they were very keen of beefing up action against human traffickers. Now, that's, of course, where countries like France and Germany and Italy, of course, really want to see more measures on the ground taken against the human traffickers.
That's reporter Catherine Field in Paris. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
The European Union has expanded the mandate of its naval and air operation that currently targets those smuggling migrants. The Associated Press reports that Operation Sophia will also monitor possible illegal oil exports from Libya. The operation's mandate, which was due to expire Thursday, has been extended to the end of next year.
Eighteen past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The top U.S. program to fight HIV/AIDS is reporting good news for Swaziland and three other African countries. PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, says the HIV epidemic is coming under control among all age groups in Swaziland, which has the highest HIV prevalence in the world. In fact, new infections among adults in Swaziland have been nearly cut in half, and treatment efforts have been successful in greatly suppressing the virus among those infected. Antiretroviral treatment has reached over 80% among adults. That's 4 years ahead of schedule. PEPFAR also reports significant progress in Malawi, Zambia, and Zimbabwe.
The Project on Middle East Democracy has issued a report analyzing the proposed U.S. foreign aid budget and its impact on democracy, governance, and human rights in the Middle East and North Africa. Stephen McInerney is the executive director and a co-author of the report. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi about the significance of the administration's deep cuts to programs that support democracy in the MENA region.
it's reflective of this administration's skepticism toward the effectiveness of foreign aid and really of non-military engagement internationally in general. What we see in this budget is large cuts to economic development assistance, large cuts to assistance to support democracy and governance programming, and even larger percentage in the past of foreign aid dedicated to military and security assistance. And I think that's consistent with what we've seen in other respects from this administration, which is sort of an increasing militarization of U.S. engagement with the world and a skepticism towards the effectiveness of diplomacy and development assistance and foreign aid.
Despite proposing substantial changes to foreign aid programs around the world, the Trump budget leaves Egypt's bilateral assistance mostly untouched. Why?
I think, you know, President Trump has began his term with having a positive relationship with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. And I suppose that he, for this reason, wanted to keep Egypt's military assistance package as it is, at $1.3 billion, one of the largest in the world. Current regime has an atrocious record on human rights. You know, today in Egypt is sort of the darkest period in Egypt's modern history in terms of political repression, how closed Egypt is politically to any forms of dissent, to any association, assembly, free expression. So it's a very dangerous path that Egypt is on. But at this point, President Trump seems to be willing to be supportive, as the U.S. government has been in the past.
But after Congress granted a new high of bilateral assistance to Tunisia past year, the new budget request proposed sharp cuts in aid to the Arab world's only emerging democracy. What do you make of that?
Well, I think this is yet another sort of troubling signal sent by the administration. It's a signal that Tunisia, which, as you rightly describe, is the Arab world's only emerging democracy, is of little interest to this administration. I think this administration, at this point, views the Middle East and North Africa primarily through the lens of the military fight against terrorism, and it has little interest in kind of broader issues, nor an appreciation for the deep connections between political progress and democratization and effectively fighting terrorism and radicalization in the long term. As we see it, and many others here in Washington look at the region, we see Tunisia's progress towards democracy as perhaps the best hope for a real lasting sort of antidote to the region's kind of cycles of political repression and radicalization and terrorism. Unfortunately, this administration, as of now, doesn't seem to share that view.
What are the major conclusions of FOMED report on the U.S. foreign aid budget to North Africa?
We believe that the president's budget request accelerates some troubling trends that have been true in the past, but are even more true under this administration. It seems to be really doubling down on the militarization of the U.S. relationship with North Africa. It seems to be not interested in the democratic progress, as we discussed, in Tunisia, and it seems to be focused on a sort of very short-term approach to fighting terrorism solely through partnering with military intelligence services and ignoring the very damaging effects of the repression of human rights for fueling anger, radicalization, and terrorism in the region.
That was Stephen McInerney, the executive director of Project on Middle East Democracy. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi. The Trump administration says the U.S. budget should be written from the perspective of the U.S. taxpayer. It's critical of programs it feels have not had a positive impact for the cost and programs that have not been authorized by Congress.
In the Gambia, President Adama Barrow has called on citizens to safeguard the country's newfound democracy. Barrow spoke yesterday during his first parliament opening since coming to power last December. Reporter Pandera Mbai has more on the story.
President Barrow said the Gambia will not return to the dark days of impunity during which armed security men abducted, tortured, and murdered citizens just to keep one man in power. He says those days are over. In his address to Parliament, Barrow underscored the importance of protecting Gambia's democracy. He said the military will no longer be used as a political tool to terrorize citizens.
Gone are the days of armed security personnel representing the face of Gambia. The Gambia armed forces are now confined to their military barracks. Members of the former State Guard battalion have been redeployed to other units, and the armed forces are now disengaged from civilian matters.
President Barrow also thanked the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, the African Union, the United Nations, the European Union, the World Bank, and other partners for what he calls their invaluable support in this historic transition period. He said peace and democracy have finally returned to the Gambia after the successful inauguration of his presidency. He praised Gambian security forces for helping to maintain peace and security in the country.
We must, however, applaud our gallant armed forces who have been receptive to the normalization of their role in the state and have conducted themselves with maximum professionalism. They continue to play a critical role in keeping our nation safe and secure.
Former dictator Yahya Jammeh left behind a poorly trained and politicized army. He promoted soldiers who were loyal to him without regard to their qualifications. But Barrow said the new government is working to improve the professional standards of Gambia's men and women in uniform.
To ensure that our military remain effective and professional, we plan to set up an infantry center and a school, as well as a military academy to train our officers and other personnel in all aspects of military science. The former National Intelligence Agency, now the State Intelligence Service, has been restructured.
The Gambian leader also commented on his government's plans to revamp the economy, fix the nation's power outages, and create a viable private sector-led economy. He said his government inherited a virtually dead economy from Jammeh. But he added that thanks to the timely intervention of the European Union, the World Bank, and other donor partners, things have started to improve. Mr. Barrow added that the Gambia has assumed its rightful role in the global community. For VOA Africa, this is Pandering by Reporting.
In Nigeria, Anglo-Dutch Shell has shut down a key oil pipeline in the south, saying it's repairing a leak. AFP reports the cause of the leak was not announced, but militants and thieves have damaged the pipeline in the past. The Trans-Niger pipeline was shut down on July 21st in Ogoniland. It sends crude to the Bonny Light Export Terminal, which has a capacity of 225,000 barrels a day. A spokesman for MOSAP, the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, says the group was not responsible for the leak. However, he says Shell is not welcome in the region, citing environmental pollution and economic injustice. Shell agreed to pay $72 million in 2015 in compensation and agreed to clean up two major oil spills.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhibe in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Our audience on VOA's FM in Accra, Ghana. We are happy to announce that VOA's FM station 98.1 is back on the air with all your favorite news and programs. Tune in every day 24/7. You can also listen to VOA's radio programs on our short waves, 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band. We are online at voanews.com.